rather than a determination or an assessment by the board of the district. That distinction, while a technicality, was significant, particularly if you read the decisions in both Cherry Hills cases, and more so in the second one, where they addressed it head on about whether a court could award compensation, and if they did award compensation, how that compensation would be characterized. And in particular, the Cherry Hills 2 case, the second Cherry Hills decision, they spent quite a bit of time evaluating how do you characterize the compensation that is awarded by a court. And of course, in that case, the compensation awarded was much more significant than what we're talking about here. I think in there it was about $9.6 million. But in some sense, that's beside the point. The root of the issue is, does the court have the authority to award compensation, number one, and it does, and number two, how is it characterized? And it's not characterized as a tax or an assessment.
Mr. Horbicek, I'm looking at the court's ruling, and there are two sentences in close proximity. One, the court says, I assume I have the ability to assess or create special assessments or taxes to impose against the city or petitioner to approve the transfer. And then a couple of sentences down, the court says, I conclude I have no authority or jurisdiction to impose a special assessment. And the way I see those, either they're both, it's an inconsistent, two sentences that are inconsistent in close proximity, or you could read it, I think, to say that the court could impose an assessment in the transfer context, but not as a tax. Would you dispute or agree with one or the other of those readings?
Your Honor, I think it's a fair question. I've seen those two. I think in addition to the other close proximity, you are correct that the court talks about saying it does, it seems to say that it does have authority to award a tax or assessment, but in three other places, it expressly says it does not believe it has the authority to impose a tax or an assessment. And I think where the court got confused, if you will, was the distinction between what the Cherry Hills decisions allow and what the statute does not allow. In Section 503, they talk about a district not being able to impose a tax going into the future against the properties that are excluded. On the other hand, 502 allows a court to consider the cost or expense to the remaining territory of the district, and in so doing, to award compensation to the remaining territory to recover what has been lost. And in that regard, it's not that the court has the authority to impose a tax, it has the authority to award compensation. And that's the critical distinction, both in the Cherry Hills decisions and I think in this case as well.
Right, and although not artfully worded, I'm wondering if the court's order can be read to express exactly the distinction that you've just articulated.
Your Honor, I don't think it can. I think one of the things that I think happened was, if you read when the court is referring to the Cherry Hills decisions in specificity, it seems to only refer to the first Cherry Hills decision. When it's referring to that decision, it talks about how the court says, and I think accurately reads, that the court can't require compensation. And that's why the first Cherry Hills decision reversed the trial court, because of that one word in the court's order, the original trial court's order in Cherry Hills, that it must award compensation. So I think the trial court here correctly interpreted that, but what it didn't do, what it failed to do, was take the next step and say, I can't say that I must award compensation, but the second Cherry Hills decision gives me the latitude to award compensation if I think it's fair and equitable. Again, looking at the various factors that 502 requires the judge to consider.
read this order of the court, say that on basis for compensation, but I just can't award it. I don't have authority. Can you read that into this order of the court?
I think, Your Honor, a fair reading of it is yes. I mean, if you look at the, again, the oral findings of the court, near the beginning of the order, the court says, I believe on two different occasions, he goes out of his way to say, I think the amount of money that the district is seeking here is reasonable. And it was also undisputed that this was the amount out there. No other numbers were thrown out. So I think the court took the first step and said, this is a reasonable amount that the district is seeking. And the court also acknowledged that this was the amount that was going to be a loss. In other words, an expense or cost or burden to the district as a result of the exclusions. And then where the court got stuck, I think, is saying, I can't award money. Or another way to look at it, near the end, the court also seems to suggest that his only option was to not allow the exclusion. And so he seems to suggest that his only option at that point was either not to allow the exclusion or to allow the exclusion and not give the money. And in our read of both the statute and the Cherry Hills, we think the court had both the authority to grant the exclusion and to put a condition on it that money would be paid. In some sense, that's what Cherry Hill stands for, that the statute requires this evaluation by the trial court, and if it's fair and equitable to award compensation, the court can do that, and it is not an impermissible tax or an assessment. I see I have about 3 minutes left. If there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve that time for rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Hrabacek, you've got about 3 minutes left.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Eric Bentley. I represent the petitioners, bar number 33792. I will be splitting my time with Mr. Hodges, who represents the city. I see my clock hasn't started. I'm not particularly familiar with these devices, but it says zero. Should I be hitting?
Ask the bailiff to start the clock. There we go.
Thank you.
Right. You just have to decide on your own how much time you each get.
because I'm splitting it, I'd like to focus on one central point, which is that on this record, there was only one conclusion that the trial court could have come to, and it reached the right result. The only fact on which Mr. Hrabacek and his client are relying is revenue loss. Revenue loss is inevitable. It is inescapable any time the territory of a special district is reduced. Territory is reduced, it's losing the tax base for those to whom it's no longer providing services. The statute identifies factors that trigger a balancing test. The balancing test is only triggered if any of those factors are met. Those are factors beyond the revenue loss, which happens automatically. The key factors identified by this fire district are number one, and this is in the factors on pages 7 to 8 of the fire district's brief, where they do have block quotes of the statute. I'm looking at page 8 at the bottom of section C. Either A, the exclusion reduces the services or the facilities, or B, it increases the cost to users in the remaining territory.
Mr. Bentley, in Cherry Hills 2, the facilities were valued at $9 million, but the facilities essentially were the Highline Canal and the trees that abut the Highline Canal. So the real basis for the $9.1 million was a loss in revenue. Loss in tax revenue.
I think, Your Honor, it was two bases. One was the facility, and the other, and specifically on page 424, of Cherry Hills 2, the court, under the heading 2, the court's explanation of its reasoning, the court states that the trial court had found, in addition to the facility transfer, that there could be a decrease in services, an increase in taxes or fees, or both. Those are the key factors that the fire district has underlined in the statute, the ones that trigger the balancing, and the ones that are present in Cherry Hills, but not in this case. There's revenue loss only. The record is crystal clear that there's no increase in cost, that tax, the mill levy does not have to be increased. There's no increase in fees or taxes, and there's no decrease in services. Services remain the same, and no transfer of facilities. And I'll give one record site that's important is page 131, which is the trial court's written findings, specifically findings 7 through 11. It makes those points. Those points are clearly supported by the record. They're not clearly erroneous, and they decide this case. And they distinguish this case from Cherry Creek. A revenue loss is automatic, so it's not in the language in the statute. It doesn't say revenue loss. The statute, as the Cherry Hills case points out, is intended to protect the rights of taxpayers, either in the excluded district or in the municipality, both, and to balance those rights. So it identifies reduction of services or facilities, or increase to cost to users, end quote, users being the taxpayers. So it doesn't say a loss of revenue that doesn't translate into increased costs to users or loss of services or facilities.
When the trial court finds that there's going to be a loss in revenue and then says it's reasonable, but I can't deal with it. I don't have any authority to deal with it. How can we read into this that he considered the loss of revenue as an increased problem for the district, and then weighed the fair and equitable result that he had to reach, given the fact that he could have awarded an amount if he thought it was fair and equitable and necessary?
Two things, Your Honor. First, we are not here to defend the trial court. We believe that its reasoning was not a model of lucidity. Our argument is twofold. One, on this record, the court could not have reached any other result because there's only loss of revenue. There's not the increased cost or loss of services or facilities. And number two, so the court reached the essential correct result, which is he essentially said, if there were a number to be awarded, that number, 32,000, is reasonable. But then he reached the right result, which is on this factual record, I do not have the authority to award anything. But we admit that he didn't get there in a clear way. And so our bottom line point is, on this record, he could, with only tax revenue identified by the district, he could not have reached any other result. So if there was error in his legal conclusions, it was harmless error under Rule 61, which states that that if the result could not have been otherwise, the legal error should be disregarded.
Couldn't the result have been otherwise? Couldn't the trial court have determined that rather than being de minimis, the loss of revenue of $32,000 was not insubstantial, and to be fair and equitable, it should be awarded to the district?
Under one condition, Your Honor, which is that if the fire district had identified and put into the record some loss beyond loss of revenue, that is some increased cost to the taxpayers, the users, that is their rates of fees went up, or their services went down, or they lost a facility. Under that condition, yes. Without that condition, Your Honor, we would say respectfully no. And if there are questions, take them. I see I have 8.5 minutes, and I will yield to my co-counsel unless there are other questions that are particularly pressing.
All right, Mr. Bentley.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hodges.
Yep. Good morning. Please the court. My name is Kenny Hodges. I represent the City of Colorado Springs, Bill Number 35205. I believe that Mr. Bentley's comments were correct as far as the intent of the statute, balancing the interests of the overlap property areas, the overlap property owners, and the interests of the remaining users of district services in a territory that's not going to be excluded after the fact. In this particular exclusion case, the trial court weighed a number of those factors. Some of them just weren't applicable to our case. Transfer of facilities, bonded indebtedness, those weren't issues for the court to consider in this case. The ones that the court did consider, and I think it's fairly clear in the court's, both the court's written order and the oral order, as far as the fact finding and the fact considerations and determinations that the trial court made, were whether or not there was a reduction of service, whether or not there was an increase of cost, and I believe those two primarily were cited in both the court's oral order and the written order. Based on that, as well as the fact that the trial court did enter a written order adopting the city's proposed plan for exclusion, that proposed plan on page 3, paragraph Roman 5, sub 1, specifically states that the plan's fair and equitable, and that plan does not include any sort of a transfer fee or a subsidy from the city to the district. Based on those factors, considering the court entered those findings of fact, we don't even really need to get to the analysis of whether or not the court's comments regarding taxes or assessments and what he had authority to do. We don't really even need to get that far, because based on the findings of fact that the court entered, the court didn't need to get to that point anyway.
So when he starts off saying he can find no basis in the statute to allow an assessment, why should we assume that he didn't just decide not to address those questions because he didn't have any authority to fix it anyway? Isn't that a reasonable reading of the order?
Your Honor, respectfully, no. And the reason is that going through the order, both the oral order and the written order, the court does consider the statutory factors. The balancing test is not the interests of the district as an entity in balancing its budget versus the interest of the overlap property owners in avoiding double taxation. It's the interest of the users of the services, and the court did actually consider those and enter findings of fact as far as those statutory factors are concerned. Specific to an increased burden, specific to reduction in services, there were none. Had the evidence been that there will be a reduction in services, for instance, an increased response time for fire protection services, if that had been the case, then the outcome might have been quite different. We may not be here at this point. But the only evidence presented by the district as far as their increased burden was simply that they're going to lose money commensurate with this piece of property that they no longer have to protect. That pointed to the district's chief testified, pointing to nothing but balancing of the budget and planning for these types of exclusion in the future, but not we are going to have to lay off a firefighter. I believe that Judge Graham brought that potential up. There was no insinuation of that sort of issue. He actually testified that we will in fact be able to provide the same level of service to the remaining territory. So we don't get past that point for the court to even have to determine whether or not it had discretion to order a subsidy or a fee in that situation. Did that answer the question, Your Honor? Thank you. As far as the merits of an argument based on equitability for the city to subsidize the district in this case, from just a bird's eye view, what we have again is an overlap area where both the city and the fire district were providing fire protection service. That overlap area, the petitioners, they filed their petition to be removed from it. The city passed a resolution that simply said, we don't object to the exclusion, we'll continue providing the service that we're already providing there. And now what the district ultimately seeks to do is be subsidized by the city of Colorado Springs for the service they're no longer providing while the city does provide that service. Regardless of the standard that this court applies to fair and equitable, as far as the court's findings are concerned, that could not be considered fair and equitable, especially in light of the economic considerations listed in the statute that the court did in fact consider.
that can't be tied to any of those. The Cherry Hills cases were quite different in that not only was there a transfer of facilities, but there was also an ongoing revenue stream to the that was going to be converted to the municipality at that point from those facilities that were being transferred. The city actually received something from it. So fair and equitable would require the transfer fee in that case. In this case, we have nothing but a simple exclusion of a fairly small amount of territory, and all that the district is seeking to do is recoup revenue to which it's no longer entitled, basically be subsidized by the city, who's now the sole provider of that, of the service in that area. Now, the danger from that sort of precedent that they're seeking is that, first, I was unable to find any sort of case in which that's actually been done. A special district exclusion in which there's no facility transfer, there's basically nothing in the statute to justify a transfer fee. The concern there is that that provides municipalities in the future a disincentive from passing a resolution that says, no, we don't object to the exclusion, and we'll continue providing the service afterward. And it would actually discourage the intent of the statute, the legislative intent that you can find in 32.1.102, which is to facilitate exclusion of overlap properties and to avoid that double taxation situation.
So are you saying if it amounts to just a simple transfer of, say, a year's worth of tax revenue, that it would not be fair and equitable as a matter of law?
In this type of case, that is exactly what I'm saying, and the reason is that it cannot be tied to any of the economic factors or fairness and equitability. So considering the trial court's findings of fact in this case, yes, that would be my assertion that as a matter of law, that a transfer fee would be inappropriate. Again, I think it would be a different story if there were a reduction in service or an increase in the cost to users. For instance, if the evidence had been that we're going to have to raise the mill levy, or there will be an increase in response time and people's houses will burn down. In that case, it's tied to one of those economic factors that the trial court's supposed to consider. And yes, in that sort of a case, it would be appropriate. That's all that I have as far as my notes were concerned. Can I answer any questions in my last 45 seconds?
Thank you, Mr. Hodges.
Thank you.
Mr. Hubachek.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of points in response. With all due respect, we don't think this is the kind of situation that would discourage exclusions in the future, as we addressed in our brief, I think, adequately. We think that's kind of a slippery slope scare tactic that is not really relevant to this case and these facts. The trial court is mandated by the statute to address the factors and evaluate the factors and then make a fair and equitable decision based on those factors. As far as lost revenue, in the Cherry Hills 2 decision, the court specifically stated that it was presuming that lost revenue was the sole reason that the trial court awarded the money to the district in that case, and they still affirmed the award. In other words, lost revenue is a factor that can and should be considered, and it's appropriate to consider it, and an award of compensation can be based on that. Also, we don't believe this is a case of harmless error. The oral findings make it clear that the judge, one, thought that the amount requested by the district was reasonable, and two, that he didn't believe he had the authority to make an award. If you take out the fact or the error that he could indeed award compensation, then we're left with the court believed the amount asked for was reasonable, and the court also agreed that it was going to be lost revenue. In other words, it was going to be a cost or an expense to the district as contemplated by the statute. So if we're left with those two things, then it is possible and indeed reasonable that the judge would have awarded compensation had he believed he could do so.
So on the basis of a fully developed record, you wouldn't remand it for additional findings by the trial court, you just reverse?
Your Honor, certainly I can conceive of one of two possibilities, either a reversal with an award of money based on the record that was submitted, or a remand to the trial court to look at the record and make a determination based on the record with the understanding that he did have the authority to award compensation. I think both of those are legitimate and possible resolutions of this case. I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you again, Messrs. Hodges and Bentley. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.